it goes without saying that there's a certain amount of, a large amount of material to be covered. One could give not just an hour-long talk, but at least an entire semester's course on the state of the universe as we know it today. But I'm not being paid nearly enough to give a semester-long course, so I'm going to try to squeeze everything into 1 hour. And my task is considerably simplified by the fact that on very large scales, the universe is smooth. It looks more or less the same. It is homogeneous, which means that from anywhere you look, it is the same. And it's isotropic, meaning in any direction you look, it looks more or less the same. Well, that's a very surprising fact we should remember, because a universe which is very, very smooth is a very low entropy state. If you have a universe which is nearly perfectly smooth but has small perturbations, those perturbations tend to grow in time. So any good theory of cosmology will try to explain to us, among other things, how it got so smooth in the first place. But for today, we're just going to take advantage of the fact that it's smooth by letting it help us organize the talk. The talk can be organized, so I have to talk about the whole universe. And the first step is to make the idealization that the universe is perfectly smooth, to talk about the parameters that tell us how to characterize a universe in which there are no inhomogeneities or anisotropies. That's the smooth universe. Then, after we do that, we can go to the next order of accuracy and talk about what the perturbations are and how they are organized and what their characteristics are, so that it's a lumpy universe. We can all agree the universe is somewhat lumpy. And after doing that, mostly on the observational side of those two issues, I will become a little bit more speculative and talk about the early universe, under which one could talk about many things. Inflation is the thing I'm going to be talking most about. There's also issues of particle relics from the early universe, the electroweak phase transition, baryogenesis, and the origin of primordial magnetic fields and so forth, which I'm not going to be talking about at all because there's just not enough time. So maybe someone else can do that some other time. Okay, let's talk about the smooth universe. We know that in the context of general relativity, if the universe is spatially homogeneous and isotropic, then there are very few forms that the metric of space-time can take. They are the Robertson-Walker metrics. And they consist of space-like surfaces, which are perfectly homogeneous and isotropic. And if you make that assumption, you only get three possibilities: constant negative curvature, flat, or constant positive curvature. So the spatial curvature is given by some parameter k, which is an integer. In fact, it's either minus 1, 0, or plus 1, depending on whether the spatial curvature is negative, 0, or positive. These are sometimes incorrectly referred to as open, flat, and closed. There's no necessary relationship between them. You can have a closed universe in the sense that it's spatially compact, even though it has 0 or negative curvature. Once you have this, if you know that the metric has a certain form, either negatively 0 or positively curved, then that tells you the geometry of space at a moment in time, and then all you have to do is say how big it is. So this space is going to expand or contract with time, and that's given by a scale factor. Which I will call A, which is a function of T. So in worlds which are spatially homogeneous and isotropic, to tell you everything there is to know, you have to tell me what k is, and you have to tell me what the scale factor is as a function of time. In the context of general relativity, there are equations which do this for us. The Friedman equation says that a dot over a squared, which we sometimes call h squared, where h is the Hubble parameter, the Hubble constant is today because it's constant over the lifetime of a cosmologist. And the Friedman equation sets this equal to 8 pi g over 3 times the density, rho, the energy density of the universe, minus k over a squared. So given the Hubble constant today as a boundary value, and given this equation, if we knew what rho was, we could tell you what a did as a function of time. It's sometimes convenient to rewrite this equation by dividing h squared and moving things around. So we have 1 minus what I can call omega curvature, equals omega, which in turn equals the sum of different sorts of omegas. Omega is called the density parameter in the kind of energy density I, and it's defined as, well, omega curvature, I've divided by h squared, and this term is what gives me omega curvature. It's kind of bad to call it omega curvature, because when I just say omega without any subscripts, I'm thinking of the sum of all these omegas, which are in actual forms of energy density, and I'm not including omega curvature. But the equation has such a nice form that I can't really help myself but write it that way. So I will define omega curvature as minus k over h squared a squared. And the other omegas are given by the energy density in species I divided by the critical density, where the critical density is something you know if you know the Hubble constant. It's 3h squared over 8 pi g. So this equation is exactly this equation. I've just redefined things. So if we want to describe the universe and its history, once again, given what h is, the Hubble constant today, as a boundary value, all we need to know are the different values of omegas, the different kinds of energy density that contribute to the universe and their different proportions, and then we can solve what the scale factor does as a function of time. So we want to know h and we want to know omega. Well, h is conveniently written as little h times 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So I'm actually first going to talk about what we know about omega, and then we talk about h. But what we know about omega is tied up with what we know about h. So I'll be often writing omega times little h. I should be pointing at these omegas. Times little h. So now you know what little h is. Traditionally, little h is known to be between about 0.5 and 1. Although we can do a little bit better than that these days, which I'll talk about later. Do you have a question, or are you just waving at me?
I'm waving.
Hi. So let's talk about omegas. Well, what do we know? We know something about omega in radiation or massless particles because, well, we think we know something. It's a theoretical sort of knowledge because there are a lot of massless particles, such as neutrinos, if they are in fact massless, whose number density and therefore energy density we don't know very well. The theory tells us that it is very close to the number density of photons, which is a species of massless particle which we do know the number density of very well. And therefore, we can compute, if the theory is correct, that omega in radiation is about 10 to the minus 4, which is much smaller than omega in other forms of matter, and therefore we're not going to worry about omega in radiation anymore. When we then go to the other forms of matter, well, what could contribute to the energy density of the universe? Are we running out of chairs? Yeah, well, you know, it's a big topic.
Well, let's open the door.
We can open the door. We'll have a timeout while we rearrange the universe. I don't want anyone to be denied knowledge of the universe. You know, some of the postdocs are very good at this because they've done it a lot. You've done it. Aki, I know you've done it. And Pear, I know, is the world's expert, right? Where'd he go? Oh, you've moved the table? This doesn't come out of my time, you know. I'm going over at the end.
I mean, look, are there more chairs than that pulpit over there?
Well, we sort of removed almost all the chairs. And besides, there's really, it's the physical space constraint that we're approaching at this point. There we go. But it doesn't keep going? Is Doreen here? You have to, someone has to walk into that little space.
The wall thrown at.
That's
it up for you.
I know, it's just
no, you're not responsible. It's everyone else.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, very good. Okay, as I was saying, omega in radiation today is thought to be very small, 10 to the minus 4, so I'm not going to pay attention to it. In the past, it was actually much larger because the different values of omega in different species grow and shrink at different rates as the scale factor changes. But today, we know for a fact that there's a non-trivial contribution from matter, that is to say, non-relativistic particles. So we'll call that omega sub m, the amount of the density parameter made up of matter. And there might be energy density in the vacuum itself. So that is a contribution from the cosmological constant. Therefore, it's referred to as omega sub lambda. So we will assume, for the purposes of the talk, that omega today, the density parameter today, consists of contributions from ordinary matter plus a potential contribution from vacuum energy. There could be more exotic things, which I'm not going to get a chance to talk about because of unitarity constraints. Here is a wonderful plot, which you should be very happy that you have me to show you, of what happens, this is the dynamics, can everyone see it? Of a Robertson-Walker space-time with density parameter given by the sum of omega lambda and omega matter. And these arrows just tell you where you go as the universe expands forward in time. So omega matter is down here from 0 to 1. Omega lambda is over here from 0 to 1. And there are three fixed points on this plot. Omega matter equals omega lambda equals 0 is a fixed point. If you're there, you stay there forever. Omega matter equals 1, omega lambda equals 0 is a fixed point. And omega matter equals 0, omega lambda is a fixed point. So from naturalness ideas, we would expect that if we didn't have any, well, to travel along the trajectory from here, from one fixed point to another, takes approximately one or several e-foldings of the expansion of the universe. So since the universe has expanded many, many e-foldings in its lifetime, it would be very surprising to be anywhere on this plot except for sitting exactly at one of these fixed points, or very, very close. Well, that's right. Here you have a saddle point. You can come in or go away. Here you have an attractive fixed point. Everyone wants to go here. Here you have a repulsive fixed point. You can be there, but everyone wants to leave. So if you were really in search of naturalness, you would say that obviously the only reasonable universe is one in which omega matter is zero and the cosmological constant makes the universe flat. The second best universe would be one in which omega matter is zero and omega lambda is zero and there's nothing there. And the absolute worst of all the natural points you could be at would be at omega matter equals one and omega lambda equals zero. This is, however, the one that everyone wants us to be at. Well, why is that the case? The answer is because we know that omega matter is not zero. It's more than zero. So we know from experiment that you're not along this line. Therefore, the only fixed point on the diagram that we have a hope it's sitting at right now or close to right now is over here. So how do we get there? Well, that's the question we would like to know. The miracle, I'll give you a short preview, the miracle of inflation is to use this diagram to its advantage by starting out in the early universe somewhere with a non-zero omega lambda, flowing very, 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 very close to this point, and then having a phase transition which turns all this vacuum energy into ordinary matter, so you end up very, very, very close to this point. But still, we might be in between here. It's an empirical question, which we're going to try to answer. So what do we know about these values, besides the fact that omega radiation is small and omega matter is not zero? Infinity is, you know, I can choose to not count that as a real number, so it's not really a fixed point. Yes, that's right. If omega lambda is sufficiently large and omega matter is sufficiently large, you can just flow to infinity. That's right. That would be the big crunch. Okay. What do we know? Well, the simplest thing to do is to look around, to count the amount of matter we have around us. And that is by using telescopes and estimating the amount of luminous matter there is in the universe. I will not go into great length about this because it hasn't changed in a long time, but I can tell you that the amount of luminous matter that we have in the universe contributes to omega at the level of a few percent, less than a percent, sorry. Less than 0.4%, to be honest. So that's not very big, really. We would therefore think that we were very close to this point if we knew nothing more. But we do know something more. For example, we can estimate the amount of baryons in the universe using the results of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. What the theory of Big Bang nucleosynthesis is able to tell us is the ratio of the number of photons in the universe to the number of baryons. And the number of photons is something we can accurately count. Almost all the photons in the universe are in the microwave background, which we can measure its intensity, we know its temperature and so forth. And so therefore we have an accurate count of the number of photons. Through Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we can get an accurate count of the number of baryons. And that count looks something like this. This is the classic diagram for Big Bang nucleosynthesis, although I got a nice color version. And what it is the abundance of different light elements versus omega baryon times little h squared. It used to be the case, not too long ago, mere months ago, that the favored range was between here and here for omega baryon. That is, omega baryon times little h squared was approximately 0.01, maybe as high as 0.02. There's then a brief moment of what was called crisis in omega baryonology, when improved measurements of the deuterium abundance, the primordial deuterium abundance, became available, because the Keck telescope, this 10-meter telescope in Hawaii, could actually look and detect the existence of primordial deuterium in clouds, which had not yet condensed into galaxies and therefore processed the deuterium, at redshifts of approximately 3. And some groups were finding it outside the range over here. Some groups were finding it upside the range over there. Many people who are perhaps optimistic seem to now believe that the issue has been settled and it's right around here. You'll notice that deuterium is more sensitive than either helium-3, helium-4, or lithium to this parameter omega baryon. And therefore, if you really do know the primordial deuterium abundance, you're in very good shape in terms of figuring out this one free parameter. And right now, people seem to be willing to believe that it's pinned down quite well at a value that sets omega baryon times a squared to be very close to 0.02. Specifically, 0.018, 0.024, I think I said, right? 6, all right, 6, close enough. So very close to 2%. Now, anytime you have such an early thing, such an experiment, an observation, which is only a few weeks or months old, you don't believe it. But you're willing to believe it because it fits in this case, with what we thought before, and you're eagerly awaiting the next round of data for someone else, a different person who is not in the original collaboration, to confirm this and say that, yes, they were right. However, right now it looks good, and certainly it looks very good, that in the near future we should pin down very accurately what omega baryon is, or at least omega baryon times h squared, what the number density of baryons versus the number density of photons is. So that's very optimistic. So there are dark baryons because omega baryon is greater than the omega that we would count if we just counted luminous matter. However, it's worse than that because then we can go and measure the gravitational mass of bound systems of stuff, either galaxies or clusters of galaxies. There are a number of different ways of doing this. The classic method is to take a cluster of galaxies, which we believe to be virialized, to be settled into some equilibrium configuration, and then use the virial theorem to figure out what its gravitational mass is. And it doesn't require that that mass is made of baryons. It could be made of anything. And then we determine, since we know both the gravitational mass and the amount of luminosity in that system, what the mass-to-light ratio is of that cluster of galaxies. And you do it for many different clusters of galaxies. And then you realize that most of the universe is actually not in clusters of galaxies, but if we make the assumption that the amount of mass versus the amount of light in a cluster is the same as that in galaxies outside clusters, then we can multiply by the amount of light and get the amount of mass in the universe. The kinds of answers you get from that have not changed very much, but they are in the range of a little bit greater than 0.2, I'm going to write omega bound, since this is in a bound system, clusters of galaxies. Not only in bound systems, but, well, what should I do? I should actually write omega m over l. This is the omega that you get from assuming that the mass-to-light ratio in bound systems is similar to that in the entire universe. it's a little bit greater than 0.2, maybe as high as 0.4 on a very good day. Okay? So this is a measurement of omega matter from looking at gravitationally bound systems. Yes? The biggest bound systems, clusters of galaxies. Superclusters aren't virialized, so they don't really count. The biggest virialized system. Oh yeah, if you wanted megaparsecs, sorry, right. Millions of light years. Megas of parsecs. And there are different ways to do this that give you slightly different answers. You can compute the ratio, the fraction of the mass which is in baryons, and then you can use the fact that you know omega baryon to determine the amount of mass in clusters. You can use gravitational lensing of quasars that are behind the clusters. You get different answers, sometimes a little bit bigger than this, but this is always the ballpark that you get. At least it has been the ballpark traditionally, and up to today, as far as I can tell, that is still the ballpark that you're getting. So it's less than 1, but it's more than omega baryon. This makes us believe that if all of these are estimates to be trusted, that some baryons are dark, and there is extra dark stuff which is not baryons, or is non-baryonic dark matter in the universe. But we're still not at one of those fixed points. We're still not at omega matter equals 1. Well, can we do better? The next thing to do is to look at the dynamics of galaxies which are not in clusters and to try to use the overall fluctuation in matter density throughout the universe, which depends on the total amount of matter, and to use the large-scale velocities or large-scale flows in between the clusters of galaxies, because this helps you estimate the amount of mass independent of whether or not all of the mass is independent of whether or not the amount of mass in a cluster of galaxies accurately reflects the amount of light in a cluster of galaxies. So there's a quantity called the bias, which tells you the amount of mass fluctuation there is relative to the amount of light fluctuation there is on any given scale. And it's very possible that mass clusters more than light, and therefore that this estimate underestimates the total amount of omega. But if you were able to get a similar estimate from galaxies which were not sitting inside virial clusters, you might be able to overcome that. And so from large-scale flows, you get, how best to say it? How did I say it when I wrote it down? From large-scale flows, the current, what I think is somewhat optimistic claim, is that omega matter is greater than 0.4. I might say 0.3 is something that I really believe. But if you look at the most recent papers by the people who look at galaxies outside clusters and use their velocities towards overdense regions and actually compute it and put the 95% confidence level estimates on there, you get omega matter is greater than 0.4. So it's just barely consistent with this, and I'm not putting an upper limit on there. It could be as high as 1. It depends very much on lots of things. These are very, very hard estimates to do. It's sort of in its infancy. It might be a technique which is as much as 5 years old, but it still has a long way to go before we have different groups doing different areas of the universe and getting consistent answers. So these are all the estimates, I'm going to tell you about that directly measure the mass density, the density parameter of matter in the universe. The story is that there is dark matter in baryons. There's also dark matter not in baryons. Omega matter might be as great as 1, but only if, for some reason, the amount of mass that clusters in a cluster of galaxies which is virialized is significantly smaller than the amount of light that is clustering in that same galaxy, in that same cluster of galaxies. We don't know why that would be the case. If you still believe that omega matter is 1, you have to explain why that matter is not falling into clusters of galaxies. And no one has a really convincing explanation for that yet. That's something that we would like to get. But continuing on in our quest to get omega on larger and larger scales to measure more and more of the universe, the next thing you might want to do is to look at the entire universe, to look at not just some amount of matter in a local region pulling on some other amount of matter and looking at the local dynamics, but rather going back to this equation and using the fact that it's the total amount of matter in the universe, not just omega in matter, but also the energy density and the cosmological constant and so forth, that contributes to h squared and also to the change in this with time. Because, of course, as the universe expands, the amount of energy density changes with time. So there are different ways to actually measure the function a of t directly. Sadly, we haven't done as well as we would like. I mean, if you think about this function a of t, we know where we are now. You might imagine doing a Taylor expansion and asking what the value of the function is, what its first derivative is, and what its second derivative is. The value of the function is not even defined, since it's something you can choose to be whatever you want. So I can choose a today to be 1. In that case, the first derivative is just the Hubble constant. And traditionally, there's this factor of 2 discrepancy. We think we can do a little bit better now, but it's not perfectly nailed down. The second derivative, we don't even know what its sign is. At least the first derivative we know is positive. We do know the universe is expanding. The second derivative, we're having a little bit more trouble. But cosmologists have never been known for their timidity. And here is a plot of the redshifts, the velocities of distant supernovae as a function of, how bright they are as a function of how far away they are in Z. And therefore, if they are standard candles, how bright they are means how far away they are, what their distance is. So this is the result from two different groups. The Supernova Cosmology Project has a bunch of little supernovae here. They hid what the redshift was, didn't they?
No, if, on the top there.
Five. 0.5. That's more like it. Between 0.2 and 0.5, not quite up at 1 yet. And as you see, there's scatter around here. These are the different curves that you would like to be able to distinguish between. But this is all very preliminary, and the idea of this is that it's to show you that eventually with more data and with better understanding, we can do it. Here's the similar curve that just came out last week from the Hi-Z supernova team led by Peter Garnovich. And they have supernovae almost out at a redshift of 1. And once again, these curves are separated by about as much as the scatter is. These might be a little bit more accurate. But from these, I have to emphasize that this is just supposed to show you that it can be done. This is not supposed to do it. But nevertheless, since you have the data, since you've been very careful, you might as well plug it in and see what you would get if you did believe it. Nothing wrong with doing that. And both groups, with cowboy boldness, did exactly that. Here's the answer from the Supernova Cosmology Project. Here's the plot of omega matter versus omega lambda, and this dark region is the region that is consistent with the data they have. Roughly speaking, at a 95% confidence level, they have the thing that you constrain using this test is omega matter minus omega lambda, and it's somewhere between minus 0.5 and 2.5. The equivalent thing from the Hi-Z, you could do better, but eventually you will do better. The Hi-Z supernova team, at 95% confidence level once again, puts omega matter minus omega lambda between minus 1 and 1. This is a little bit more uncomfortable making for inflationologists, because if you really want omega matter to be 1 and omega lambda to be 1, then this should be omega lambda to be 0, then this should be 1. And that's sitting right outside this contour that says 95% confidence level. But this is very preliminary, and it's also very hard. As an illustration of exactly how hard this is, if you look at this paper by Garnovich et al., they make a great tra-la-la about being extremely careful and worrying about systematic errors. And nevertheless, they consistently, one might almost say systematically, misspell my name in the text of the paper and in the reference. And then they expect us to put the fate of the universe in their hands. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't speak to their credibility very well. If we were to combine the two limits that I put on there, which are admittedly preliminary, but also they're not overclaiming, we would get that between minus 0.5 and 1 is the difference, omega matter minus omega lambda. These kinds of tests, of course, will ultimately be decisive because they measure what the whole universe is doing, not a little cluster of galaxies. And finally, we can get limits on omega lambda directly by using the statistics of gravitational lenses, the frequency with which we see gravitationally lensed objects. Because in a universe dominated by the vacuum, the physical volume between us and a fixed redshift is much larger than in a universe dominated by matter. And therefore, the number of lenses that you would expect to be between us and a quasar or redshift of 3 is much larger. Therefore, if you get statistics on, for unbiased catalogs of gravitational lenses, how many you see versus how many you expect, you can put limits on the cosmological constant. And from lenses, right now, The most fearless claim is that omega lambda is less than or equal to 0.65 at the 95% confidence level. So this is, well, it excludes one of those fixed points at omega lambda equals 1 and omega matter equals 0. We knew already we weren't there. It does not exclude sitting at some interesting point along the line of omega total equals 1 between omega matter equals 1 and omega lambda equals 1. So it's a very interesting limit, but it doesn't kill off interest in the cosmological constant quite yet. Okay. That is what we need to know about the density parameter. Now we turn to the sad story of the Hubble constant, which I'm very reluctant to talk about because there's people in the room who know more about it than I, but all of the other topics I'm talking about, there are also people in the room who know more about it than I, so I shouldn't be dissuaded. Here is H naught, and as I mentioned to you before, traditionally, this is in kilometers per second per megaparsecs, obviously astronomers' units. It's not in inverse GeV, which would be natural. Here's the traditional range between 50 and 100. And I want to make a tiny little argument that today the range is more like between 60 and 80. What is that tiny little argument? Well, there are many ways to measure the Hubble constant, and they can be roughly divided into ones that use a cosmic distance ladder to use smaller distances to give us the absolute brightness of objects at a certain distance, and therefore use those at a further distance to give us more absolute brightnesses, and so forth. And there are more methods which use things for which we should know from physics what the brightness or the size of it is, and then use those to measure the Hubble constant. So in the latter one, in the physics derived methods, there are at least three which have gained some attention. One is the expanding photosphere method using type 2 supernovae, the world's expert of which is Brian Schmidt, who will be giving a talk here tomorrow on a different topic. And that method seems to give you numbers which are nicely in the 70 range, so they don't really, so they make you think that yes, we're on the right track, but they don't. They're not as dramatic. It's dramatic when you get something over here, over here. And it's a very solid method. I don't think you can argue with it very much. But type 2 supernovae don't, you know, we can't control where they appear, and we also can't control the fact that they're not as bright as we would like. So they're not the cure-all. Another method based on physics is the use of gravitational lenses. If you have a quasar that sits behind a galaxy and it is lensed, so there's two images of it, and the quasar is varying brightness in time, then there are time delays along the two paths. And the amount of time delay that you have depends on the distance it's traveled, and therefore it depends on the Hubble constant. If you know something about the lens, then you can extract from what the time delay is what the Hubble constant is. However, you usually don't know enough about the lens as you would like. And therefore, this is a method which is very physical and very clean in principle, but in practice, there are tremendous astrophysical uncertainties associated with it. Gravitational lens measurements tend to be at the low end, even less than 50, like 40 or 50. But if you say, well, how far could I really push it without doing violence, you can easily get up to 80 or even higher. So this is something which, once again, has promise for the future, but is not something which right now is a cure for anything. And finally, there's the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. If you look at microwave background photons which pass through a cluster of galaxies, they're often scattered off the hot gas in the clusters, which gives you an amount of, which is an independent measurement of what the cluster is doing besides the actual direct measurement you can get of its luminosity in X-rays. And when you combine these two things, you can get the absolute luminosity of the cluster. Therefore, you know how bright it is, and if you also know how far away it is, you get its distance. This is very similar to the gravitational lens test in that it's very physical. You don't need to climb up any distance ladders, but there are astrophysical uncertainties in the measurements. If the gas clumps, then it can change things. If you don't know the shape of the cluster, then it can also change things. And just like the gravitational lens measurements, it tends to give low answers, but once again, if you ask how far can you push it up, you can push it up to the top of the interesting range. So it's a hope for the future, but isn't there yet. Therefore, I will judge that the real work of measuring the Hubble constant and the cosmological distance scale is still being done by distance ladder type methods. And what has happened is that there's a reason to believe this distance ladder type methods, based on mostly the Cepheid distance scale, are now telling us the Hubble constant is between 60 and 80. Well, what has happened? On the high end coming down, it's more or less been a matter of hard work and better techniques. That as you more and more understand the Cepheid distance scale itself, especially due to Hubble Space Telescope measurements of Cepheids in distant clusters, for which we can get more direct distances right now, these types of measurements have continually been going down. There's a whole bunch of methods that go under this rubric. Tully-Fisher distances, surface brightness fluctuations, DN sigma, and stuff like that. And they're all in the range now. They tend to be, let's say, between 70 and 80. I believe that's the favored average value that the Hubble Space Telescope Key Project has is right now about 73. Is that true? Are there any members in here? 73? At the small end, there's a devoted and plucky group of people who still think that the Hubble constant is 50, and they have and Sandage and Tamman are, of course, the names that are most famously associated with this. And what has happened to their value? Well, nothing has happened to their value. They still think it's 50, but they have a lot of different ways of getting it, some of which are more respectable than others, the most respectable of which is the use of type 1 supernovae at standard candles. And the type 1 supernovae have been giving low values of the Hubble constant for a while, but we know today, due to the work of Phillips and Rees, Preston, Kirshner, and Hamwi et al., is that everybody? Most of the important people, that they're not...
The theorists,
yeah. Type 1 supernovae are not precisely standard candles. Their brightness varies a little bit, and it varies in a way which we can understand and correct for given the shape of their light curves. So if you take the self-same supernovae that are giving you low values and you correct them using the fact that their light curve helps you understand precisely what their brightness is, then instead of getting numbers around here, you start getting numbers in the upper 60s. Therefore, if you read papers by Wendy Friedman, who is the boss of the Space Telescope Key Project, she will tell you the Hubble constant phase between 60 and 80, and most people will agree. However, an informal survey of AstroPH of last year has convinced me that people have not stopped writing papers that say the Hubble constant is either 50 or 90. So even though there are reasons to believe it's between 60 and 80, it's not as if everyone would agree with that. So what I'm telling you is, of course, every sentence I say in the talk is objectively true based on the evidence, but I can't help it if not everyone agrees. Do any experts in the audience want to disagree with what I just said?
Yes.
Yes? What do you think?
Yes, I think you're exactly. I don't know of any values above 58 or above 73. And Sanders and Cameron have come up to at least 58 and no longer claim a significant difference in their value and MMA, which are at 53.
Okay, I mean, that's not very at odds with what I said, yes?
Yeah, that's true. Essentially, all your forgotten physical methods, type 1A, are also physical methods.
That's true, yes.
It's very constant since several years, something between 60 and 70, from various different views. And I think that at least a good measurement as anything else. So you know the decay energy from people very well.
Yes.
So you know the energy.
Okay. I hereby include it. Any other opinions or facts? All right. Well, once again, it's not settled yet, but I do believe that most people, in fact, almost everyone, if nothing else, believes that we are converging, that progress is being made, and it's not the case where 20 years from now there will still be a factor of two difference. It will be much smaller than that. Okay. The final parameter we might want to... Oh, my goodness. The final parameter we might want to... get is the age of the universe, T0. Well, how do you get that? Of course, you could get it if you knew all the parameters in this equation. And you can, of course, by guessing that omega matter equals 1, that you know the Hubble constant is. You can measure if omega matter equals 1, the Hubble constant... If omega matter... No, I'll put this on a transparency, so we'll save time. Besides solving the Friedman equation, the way that you can get the age of the universe is to measure the age of some of the stuff in the universe and use the reasonable assumption that the universe is greater than or equal to the age of the stuff in it. The oldest thing that we can get the age of reliably are globular clusters. And until recently, the answer has been that the age of globular clusters was approximately 15 billion years and a very respectable lower limit of 12 billion years. That caused problems because from plugging in what we know about omega and H, we tend to get numbers like 10 or 11 billion years for what the age of the universe is, and it can't be younger than globular clusters. Recently, there's been a change in the weather, mostly caused by the Hipparchus satellite, which measures parallaxes very accurately of stars. So here's a picture that I got from the Hipparchus webpage. Can anyone tell me what this is? It is Ursa Major in three dimensions. In other words, if you were wearing glasses with a green filter in one eye and a red filter in the other eye, you would see a three-dimensional version of Ursa Major, the Big Dipper, the Great Bear. You can see that for each little red blob, there's a green blob. And the three-dimensionality of it is real. The distance that you would perceive is proportional, although not equal to, the actual distance of those stars in the sky. So this gives you an idea of what Hipparchus has done. It has measured the parallax to many, many, many more stars, the accurate distance, just by using geometry, to many, many more stars than we have ever had before. And what has this done for us? Well, it's allowed us to measure the distance to globular clusters better than ever before, not because we can measure the parallax to globular clusters, but because we can measure the parallax to the kinds of stars that you see in very old globular clusters and then match. So here is a HR diagram, color versus magnitude diagram of an old globular cluster, and these little things with error bars are the absolute magnitudes determined of low mass, low metallicity, therefore very old stars to which Hipparchus has measured the parallax. The amazing thing is that once you know this, you realize that the globular clusters were further away than you thought. And because they're further away and you know what their apparent brightness is, their absolute brightness is higher than you thought. They're burning fuel, therefore, more quickly than you thought, and therefore they're younger than you thought. And now it is believed that the best fit to the age of globular clusters is approximately 12 billion years, with a lower limit of 10 billion years, which fits in quite nicely. Well, it could be better. You can't go lower than 10 because there's independent methods using nucleocosmochronology, which give a pretty firm lower limit of 10 billion years to the age of the universe. But for reasonable values of omega and the Hubble constant, you still might be able to squeeze in there. Different assumed reddenings to different clusters. M30 has a reddening of 15.2 here, 14.95 there. As you see, it makes almost no difference.
Well, I mean, it's appropriate to skip over a lot of the details, but there are a lot of questions about whether, how strongly one should draw that inference based on the distances to some nearby stars that are like the stars in globular clusters, get to interpolate for abundance differences, and some that you measure dwarfs, some that you measure giants. And if you use this distance for the center of the galaxy, you would make a rotation curve of the galaxy look very funny. I mean, there are lots of other questions about this. The purpose of this talk,
there should be, I don't want to say over and over again, but because I'm trying to tell you all the stuff that has happened in the last year, you should always think that anything that has happened in the last year isn't verified as absolutely true yet. We have to wait until we do better. We need another independent measurement besides Hipparchus that gives us this stuff, and we need to understand the astrophysical systematics better. Absolutely true. But at least it's hope. Hope is a good thing. Is there still a problem? Well, there might be, depending on what the other values of the parameters are. If you believe that omega matter equals 1 and omega lambda equals 0, and the age really is 12 billion years or above, then the Hubble constant has to be 55 or less, which is not in that range. You can turn it around, say that if you know that omega matter is at least 0.2, and if the age of the universe really is 12 billion years, and you happen to measure the Hubble constant accurately to be greater than 70, then you know that the cosmological constant is non-zero. So certainly measurements like this give us a great possibility for discovery if we pin down these numbers, T0 and H0, even better than we know them now. Especially because I was very loose here, omega matter greater than 0.2. If I make it greater than 0.4, we don't have to even have that high a Hubble constant before we need a cosmological constant. What this means, in other words, is that an open universe, which would be a little bit older than a flat universe, might not be enough if we get these measurements to be sufficiently accurate. So there's still room for improvement. Okay, that's the smooth universe. And now we'll go to the lumpy universe, the anisotropic universe. When I say anisotropic, of course, I don't mean things like were recently claimed to exist in the polarization measurements of distant radio galaxies by Noblin and Ralston. These guys said that, as many of you know, that if you look at the polarization from distant radio galaxies, it twisted as it came toward us in an anisotropic way, and this was immediately leapt on by any number of people, including myself, and the controversy is dead in terms of working cosmologists, but in popular press it lives on. So if you look at the October issue of The Sciences, there's a little article in here, which I'll just read you an excerpt. At the University of California, Santa Barbara, the theoretical physicist Sean Carroll argues that Noblin and Ralston forced their random data into a predetermined design. Once the astronomers assumed that light would rotate in certain directions, he says, all the rest followed. And it goes on, Noblin and Ralston argue that Carroll's assumptions are poorly grounded in mathematics. If Carroll were an undergraduate in physics, Ralston says, he would have gotten an F on his report. I know. Now I know how Nixon felt. So the controversy rages on. I'm going to stay out. So once we think we know something about the parameters which characterize the absolutely smooth universe, the next step is to look at the universe which is lumpy. There's two simple ways to do this. There's two basic ways. There are millions of ways. But they fall into two basic classes, looking at the microwave background and anisotropies, and looking at the positions of galaxies. So here's a plot of a lot of galaxies from the Las Campanas Redshift Survey. And we see that it is not perfectly homogeneous. There are little voids. There are emptier regions than others. But still, this survey is at a sufficiently large scale that if you squint, things begin to become homogeneous. We're actually seeing an approach to homogeneity as we go to larger and larger scales. The thing that's always worried me is that I can draw a little circle around us, which seems to be more empty than if I drew a circle there. But I don't know. You have a paper about that. I'm not so surprised. But this is the kind of thing that's being done better and better. We've reached the point where we can really begin to understand at a quantitative level the approach to isotropy, the approach to homogeneity, while understanding the characteristics of the inhomogeneities. The other thing that you can do besides that, if you wanted to take this and turn this beautiful picture into quantitative results that you could test predictions for, you would calculate the power spectrum. So the power spectrum comes from looking at delta, which is delta number over number, the fluctuations in the number density of these galaxies. Fourier transform that function of space into a function of k and take the expectation value of its absolute value squared, and you get the power spectrum. And here are the answers for what the power spectrum is for different kinds of surveys. The first thing you begin to notice is that they don't agree. These curves should all be lying on top of each other if all of these curves actually measured not just the number density of things you look at, but actually the mass density, because, of course, the mass density is what it is. It should be a single curve. Therefore, there is such a thing as bias, at least at this level. The number density fluctuations in different kinds of things as a function of scale are not the same for different kinds of things. IRAS galaxies are redder and younger. They may have a low power. These are optical galaxies, which have this medium power. These are radio galaxies, which have a high power. So they don't cluster equally. But we can try to take this information and turn it into some average that gives us information about the clustering of mass on these scales, and that is what people do. The other thing you can do, as far as observations are concerned, is to look at the microwave background. This is a picture of the microwave background. This is from the two-year COBE data set. You can see there are fluctuations, hot and cold spots. There's a fluctuation here because I touched the ink before it dried with my finger, so that doesn't count as data about the universe. And also these lines here were not actually seen on the sky. These were put there by human beings after. And of course, you subtracted out the dipole anisotropy, and there's a model of the galaxy, which you've made and subtracted that out as well. So this is an approximation of what the fluctuations in the real sky look like. Once again, you'd like to take this pretty picture and turn it into something quantitative. So what you do is you plot these C sub L's, which I'll have to show you. I'll have to write down what those are. So for galaxies, you get power spectra. P of K, which is the expectation value of the Fourier transform of delta K squared. For CMB anisotropies, you get C sub L's, which are the expectation value of A sub L's squared, A sub LM's squared, actually, where A sub LM is defined by, if you know delta T over T as a function of position on the sky, the fluctuation in temperature, you expand it in spherical harmonics, and the coefficients of the spherical harmonics YLM are just the ALMs. Yes? K is wave number, 1 over 2 pi over wavelength for a Fourier transform. Yep. So it gives you the length scale over which the fluctuation is occurring. Whereas L, it's theoretically all the M's for a given AL should have equal expectation values of their magnitude squared. Therefore, C is a function of L, where L is the multipole moment on the sky, and it's approximately equal to 180 degrees over the angle. So small L's are large angles, large L's are small angles, and these are the observations to date, many of which have a Santa Barbara flavor, including, well, COBE, of course, MSAM, Python, MAX, and naturally the UCSB South Pole experiment, a little piece of Santa Barbara in the Antarctic wastes. And this is what you get from the observations. COBE got these first, and now we're getting smaller and smaller scale observations, which include this rise from the COBE level to something up here, and then it looks like they're going down again. A peak in the C sub L's, which will be very important for us before too long. Okay, what do I want to tell you next? Well, that's the observations, very, very rapidly, of the lumpy universe. The power spectrum is something you get from redshift surveys or galaxy surveys, and the C sub L's are something you get from the microwave background. What do you do with it? Well, you ask, where did it come from? You're a good theorist, and you want to know what kind of initial conditions could have given you such a universe that we observe today. Well, there are two sets of possibilities. So what are the theories? Set one would be causal perturbations, which is a terminology which I dislike, but they never ask me before they invent these words for these different things. And acausal. And what this means is perturbations which are only generated within a horizon size. That is to say, two points which are causally disconnected if the universe did not inflate have no coherent fluctuations over them, but there's something going on within the horizon, and as the horizon size grows and grows and grows, these fluctuations are generated on larger and larger scales. And there's a physical mechanism for doing this, namely topological defects. Acausal is to imagine that over sizes even larger than the horizon, there is some fluctuation imprinted at very early times. It sounds like impossible. How could that ever happen? But we already know that something funny happened because the points on antipodal ends of the microwave background have approximately the same temperature, even though they've never been in causal contact, unless you believe in inflation or something like that. So since they're so close to each other, there's no reason to believe they can't deviate from each other a little bit, and this would be what is known in the trade as an acausal theory of perturbations. And of course, there is a perfectly good theory that does that, which is inflation. So the news of the day is that possibility one is dead. It's not true. We've ruled it out. And how is that possible? Well, it's been around a long time. Why is it that we so recently ruled it out? The very brief version of why we've been able to rule it out is because we have better numerical simulations now, and there are better techniques for doing the simulation, so we can accurately predict what the power spectra of these theories are and what their microwave background predictions are. Here is the power spectrum for defect models versus the observations. Normalized, you can't choose the normalization of these curves because COBE gives you the normalization on very large scales with the microwave background. Then you ask, does it fit the observations of the power spectrum on small scales? And the answer is no. This green curve is standard cold dark matter, which is an inflationary model, which has acausal perturbations. And then you have different causal models from monopoles, textures, non-topological textures, which are just scalar fields, and strings. And they're all like this. They don't fit at very small scales, and they are disastrously off on large scales. So it doesn't fit. It doesn't work. And these are reliable theoretical curves for the first time. This is something that's new in the past year or so. If you're not convinced, I can show you what the microwave background predictions are from these same models. Here are the data that you just saw before with this peak going up here. Here are the predictions from these models normalized to COBE, so the fact that they work at small L's is not impressive. That's how we picked it. On large L's, small angular scales, they're just off by, for any one point, you could believe that it's off by that much, but all the points are inconsistent. So it doesn't work. It's ruled out.
Are you going to start the curve for checking out
this one? Yes? You mean for defects?
For defects or any single version of that?
Well, I'll show you curves, and then you can decide whether they go through the points. How's that? I'm trying to be fair, you know, since this is a review talk. The reason why you believe this stuff is because the people who are saying it are the ones who have spent their entire careers working on topological defects. In this case, Neil Turok is one of the people. Wei-Li Pan also has spent his somewhat briefer career working on topological defects. Similar curves can be found in papers by Andy Albrecht and people like that. Turok is the one person who believes that he can, in principle, invent a theory of topological defects, which involves defects which go away at late times due to some very late time phase transition, which might be able to fit. But any respectable theory of topological defects is dead.
Does this depend on whether you assume hot dark matter with your topological defects? Or
no. Briefly, the answer is, yeah, it's been a question for a long time whether or not hot dark matter would be a better kind of dark matter to have with defects or not. But these simulations are sort of the best you can do. In other words, these fit better than the ones with hot dark matter when you actually plug in the numbers.
So Turok used to have a big peak in his texture simulation. Did that go away just to calculations or physics? Or
if you didn't know what the observations were, you could make that look like a big peak by scaling it appropriately. The only way, you can have a peak that goes up like this and then it wobbles down like this. But you can't do it, as they say, with a respectable theory of defects. You can design theories of defects to give you more or less any spectrum you want. But it's not what you get if you just plug in some phase transition at the gut scale and let the strings evolve unmolested. And furthermore, it would not fit with the power spectrum data. So if you want to fit everything at once and, you know, save your respectability quotient, then you just say, nope, it didn't work. It was a fun 15 years. Let's move on. I've worked on this stuff, too. So, you know, you have to believe me. All right. Well, does inflation do any better? Oh, yes. Topological defects are dead, I keep saying, but they're dead as a theory of structure formation. They're not completely dead. They still might do other useful things for astronomy. So I have for you here, to prove that they might do other useful things, I have a poster. So we'll need the lights. This is a poster for a conference that's going to happen in a couple of weeks on cosmic rays at very high energies. And there's anecdotal evidence given by the fact that in the lower right corner there's a picture of it, which I generated, of a texture collapsing and giving monopole, anti-monopole pair nucleation at the site where the texture collapses. So the fact that this picture appears on this poster, I take as evidence that topological defects are not yet dead, since at least somebody believes, apparently, that they might have formed very high-energy cosmic rays. I never would have suggested such a thing myself. Inflationary models do a little bit better, but they don't do as well as we would like. If you look at the standard vanilla cold dark matter model with a scale-free density perturbation spectrum, a Hubble constant of approximately 50, omega equals 1 in matter and no cosmological constant, the curve you get is this blue one. It's normalized to COBE, and it doesn't fit. These are the data sort of merged together by a way of getting the underlying mass fluctuation power spectrum. And I hate this graph, but it's the best one I could find because it's in nice colors and things like that. All right, I'll hide the names of the authors. Because they have, this is little s cold dark matter, and this red curve is just cold dark matter. And you would look at this red curve labeled cold dark matter and say, wow, it fits everything. But this is cold dark matter with a Hubble constant of 30, which it isn't. This is cold dark matter with a Hubble constant of 50, which is sort of as small as you're permitted to let it go, and it doesn't fit. And there are other curves, though, that do a lot better job of fitting. The lambda cold dark matter curve fits a little bit better. At small scales, it comes closer to the data than the regular cold dark matter does. New CDM, which is omega of about 0.8 in cold stuff and omega of about 0.2 in massive neutrinos, hot dark matter, does a very good job. It's this dotted blue curve. It goes almost right through. And then this cooked-up model here, tau CDM, increases omega radiation, which I erased, by a factor of 10 or 20 or something like that. And shockingly, it fits. But there's no real reason to do that unless instead of three generations, you have 15. These are massless neutrinos that you would be adding. These are massive neutrinos, and you only need three of them instead of 12 extras besides the three that we know exist. Because the other reason why this is not a good plot to draw is because COBE is not measuring the same thing that the redshift surveys are measuring, and therefore the correct way to normalize any given theory to COBE depends on what theory you're using. And for a lambda CDM, the COBE normalization is just in a different place than for the omega equals 1 CDM type models. And therefore, I mean, once again, I don't like drawing these pictures, but I do want to show you that these models do better than the defect models at fitting these data. But the vanilla model doesn't work. In fact, let me emphasize the fact that the vanilla model is ruled out. It's been ruled out for many years, and every month they write another paper saying, here's why it's ruled out this month. So I found a recent paper from this year by Strauss, Osbrecker, and Chen, which looks at the velocity dispersions of galaxies, just pairwise, two at a time, which is something that's been looked at a long time, but they now do it as a function of density. Because there's this criticism that since most galaxies you're observing are very close together in very high-dense regions, you're not being fair. So they said, well, let's just do it as a function of density. Here is the theory. These black curves, in theory, you have to do a large-scale numerical simulation, and then all these little tiny curves are the different Monte Carlos that you've done. So here are the error bars you get, and here are the observations, which are consistently low, and at these particular scales are just preposterously low. So this is telling you once again that the cold dark matter model doesn't work. The way in which it doesn't work is that it predicts too much power at small scales. 5 years ago, we said it predicted too little power at large scales because we didn't know about COBE. Now we know what the absolute normalization is. Can't play with that. And over again, in many different ways, you find that cold dark matter has too much power at small scales. In a sense, this is reassuring because we know from clusters of galaxies that there's not the correct amount of matter in clusters of galaxies to make omega equals 1 cold dark matter work. So the fact that, once again, you're finding that if you put omega equals 1 in ordinary matter and put it and follow what the numerical simulations do. The numerical simulations, on the one hand, say that it would be in clusters of galaxies, but it also says that those theories don't work. So at least it's consistent.
When you say it doesn't work, that's assuming omega equals 1.
Yes. That's right. Open models do a little bit better. Still not perfect. Of course, the real excitement, the thing to do is the microwave background, right? To observe it really well. Here's how well we've observed it so far. And I can show you some theoretical predictions. Here is standard cold dark matter, the model which I just told you was ruled out. And it does pretty well at the microwave background. I mean, it does really well, actually. Too bad it's ruled out, I mean, because it does really well. It is a little bit under these black points here, which are the Saskatoon measurements, but it has this peak, it has little tiny peaks which you could hope to measure very precisely in the future, and it's all very encouraging. And now I can tell you, the wonderful thing about the microwave background is, as you vary any of the parameters in your cosmological model, the prediction changes. And for the most part, they change in ways which you would be able to observe, and with a really good experiment, which are coming in the near future, detect. So here's the equivalent model with a high cosmological constant of 0.65. That's the upper limit right now. And here's the prediction. And it also fits very well. It's just a matter now. Now it fits through these Saskatoon points. It does not fit as well through the M-SAM points. So if I set omega lambda to be 0.5, it would go through here and it would fit through everything. So does that come close to answering your question? That's the best you could do. If I did not believe in my... that's too much to ask, sorry. I agree. There's no theory that fits both perfectly. If I really wanted to tell you the theory of the universe that fit all the data the best in my personal estimation, it would have omega matter equals 0.5, omega lambda equals 0.5. It's just ugly. I would hate to admit to my children that I was a cosmologist if that turns out to be the right answer. And Joe said he would resign if it were the right answer, so... of course, he's been saying he resigned for different reasons, so he better be careful. Here is, if I change the Hubble constant, it also raises the height of that peak a little bit. Since I'm running out of time, I'm going to give you the panoply of models all at once. How about that? One might say I have run out of time. This is not a philosophical exercise, since there will be a satellite launched scheduled in the year 2000, which will measure the microwave background to very good accuracy. And even before then, balloon experiments, partially done by people here at UCSB, should measure the Doppler peak well enough to probably tell us what omega is, if nothing else. The beautiful thing here, there's many curves. I hope you can see them. I can change omega lambda, I can change omega matter itself, I could change the fraction of baryons, I could change the Hubble constant, and I can change the tilt in the initial power spectrum. All of them give distinct curves at the level which we should be able to discriminate against. Eventually, our arguments about omega matter, omega lambda and the Hubble constant, will be at the couple of percent level, not at the factor of two level. My favorite fact about this is that I have here a number of models, only one of which has omega total being less than 1. And it is also the only one that has the location of this peak somewhere besides here. It is a fairly robust prediction of all these models. The location of the peak, if omega total, which is omega matter plus omega lambda, is 1, then the peak is located at an L of 220. And it moves upward if omega total is less than that. And this is something which we'll be able to measure probably within 2 years. And therefore, we'll know what omega is. Isn't that great? I mean, this is really great. Yes?
What's the second curve going up through the pi data?
The blue one is a baryon fraction of 15%. Not bloody likely, really, but something we could imagine being the case. So this is the hopeful future for cosmology, and this is why in the past 2 years, lots of people who have... By the way, I should say that all these theoretical curves are courtesy of a code written by Yuro Seljak and Matthias Zaldiraga, who did the very non-glamorous thing of sitting down and saying, how can we make the existing microwave background codes work much faster? It used to take a day on a supercomputer to generate one of these, but these guys sat there and thought very hard and worked very diligently, and now I can run it on my computer on my desk, and it takes 10 minutes to construct one of these theoretical curves. So it's very easy for even someone like me to generate all these curves in an afternoon. Which is... Sorry?
What is the special significance of 2020? Is it the size of the...
It is approximately the angular scale corresponding to the physical size of the horizon at the moment of decoupling. And it's a geometric effect. The reason why what it depends on is omega total is because it actually depends on the curvature of the space-like slices. It doesn't depend on the actual matter content of which is influencing how the evolution of those space-like slices goes. Okay? So in the last seconds, I was going to tell you wonderful things about inflation, but I can't. I've run out of time. The wonderful thing about inflation is that we can learn things about it from observations. That we can learn things about what the slope of the potential of the scalar fields in the very early universe was. And furthermore, we can learn things about the absolute height. The wonderful thing is that the height of the potential comes directly into the prediction for gravitational wave perturbations of the microwave background. And there's a formula for it, that the amplitude of the tensor perturbations is just 0.6 times the height of the potential, the value of the potential at the time when those fluctuations that made whatever scale you're looking at were being generated, divided by the Planck mass to the fourth power. So since we have an upper limit on the fluctuations already, we can turn this into a limit on what the value of the potential was at that scale, and it is that this is less than or equal to 3.4 times 10 to the 16 GeV. We know that if inflation did in fact generate the fluctuations we see in the microwave background, then the energy density of the universe at the time they're being generated is less than this, which is another spectacular finding. And it reminds us of how difficult it will be to construct successful or not successful, but believable models of inflation. Because if inflation really does, there's every reason to believe that inflation begins at very high scales. Because if it didn't begin at high scales, then how did it, what was happening to the universe before it got to the low scales where it began? And therefore, we would want a theory of inflation, if it were to be successful, to include things that were happening right up there at the gut scale, or at the Planck scale, or wherever we believe that inflation was happening. At that scale, there's all these fields lying around. Probably supergravity is important, and perhaps even superstrings are important. As an illustration, I'll briefly flash up to you this last transparency, which is derived from a paper by this Witten fellow. And what he says is that you can make the gravitational coupling constant meet at the same point when all the coupling constants of the gauge theories meet. At a point up here, all you have to do is ask that the universe be 11-dimensional, and that whereas six of the dimensions are a very tiny ball, approximately 1 over 10 to the 16 GeV in length, the 11th dimension is 1 over 10 to the 15th GeV in length. So as you approach energies of 10 to the 16 GeV, you don't even know what the dimensionality of space-time is, much less what the accurate particle theory is at this point. So despite the fact that inflation seems to be doing extremely well as a theory for generating initial conditions for the universe, working out the details of how inflation happened and matching it up with a particle theory which is believable at very high scales is a task which will take a long time to do in the future and deserves a lot of effort. Thank you. Measured yet. If you knew, the only one of your statements I disagree with is that if you have perfect knowledge of the microwave background that you couldn't tell. I think if you have perfect knowledge, you can tell almost everything. But the point is, if you knew, the first thing you learn with confidence is the location of the peak, the L at which the peak happens, and that is a function of omega lambda plus omega matter, an orthogonal combination of the omega matter minus omega lambda that the supernova you're telling us. So as we march forward in time from 1997 to 1998, etc., it will be the supernovae plus observations of the microwave background that first allow us to discriminate between different value, different contributions to omega total. But once we have perfect knowledge, we will have the height of this peak as well as its location, and that will help us to distinguish between the amount of omega which is in matter versus lambda. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand, but there are linear combinations of the parameters are what are really determined. And I think there's an illusion out there that you will determine these things separately just from the microwave background.
Well, I'm not sure if I would agree with that. There was a point in time when this claim was made that there was something called cosmic confusion, where no matter how much you knew about the microwave background, you would not be able to figure out the different values of the parameters because they were degenerate. But as John implies, that was under a pessimistic set of assumptions about how much we know about what happens at very, very small L's. This, for example, is two curves, standard CDM with a Hubble constant of 50 versus a Hubble constant of 90. And you see that out here, I mean, in this region, it would be hard to tell the difference between these curves unless you had very accurate measurements. But once you got to very high L's, the very number of peaks would change, shorter of omega, of lambda, of L equals 1,000. So it becomes harder and harder to measure these guys as you move further and further out. But if you really did have perfect knowledge, you'd be able to do really good. And I would hesitate to say that you wouldn't be able to measure anything, especially because none of this includes polarization, which is another thing, which might be the smoking gun. Well, this wasn't really answered the question, but now that I am going to tell you about it, you have no choice but to listen. The way to make sure that inflation is right is to measure the polarization of the microwave background, because that will tell you information about the tensor fluctuations, and there is a relationship in inflation that the spectral index of the tensor fluctuations is minus the amplitude of the tensor fluctuations over 7 times the amplitude of the scalar fluctuations. So if you measured tensor fluctuations at very small scales and very large scales, you'd be able to measure whether or not this was true. And there's a prediction of inflation which is at the level where if it were shown to be verified, you would have to be nuts not to believe that inflation was correct. Vice versa is not so obvious because you could always make... Furthermore, you don't really have a prayer measuring this because you would have to... Well, yeah, this is really tough to measure. But in principle, I do want to emphasize that beyond the fact that the universe is flat and almost homogeneous, inflation does predict other things, and it is possible to get to a level of confidence in inflation where we'd be really convinced. But okay, that's very far away from your question. Do you have more, or are there other questions?
Is there anything else about the early? I mean, are there new results on that?
None sufficiently fascinating. I was planning on including them in my talk. The electroweak phase transition is the object of a lot of study, but it's a messy place. And it's at the level where, you know, topological defects were at a few years ago, that the simulations and the approximations just are not good enough. The consensus seems to be that if in the minimal standard model, there's no way to get enough CP violation or a sufficiently strongly first-order phase transition to have successful electroweak barrier genesis. If you add extra Higgs fields and extra CP-violating parameters, such as in supersymmetric versions of the standard model, then there seems to be no obstacle to doing it, but there's also not a compelling single model which does it. Let me see if there's anything else I was going to say besides that. Probably not. I think that's it. Anything else? Gary?
Do you know how large L is that a map will be able to measure?
Yes. That is to say, no. It's very high. It's probably...
A couple hundred.
It's past the first peak, right? How high does MAP go?
In the science channel, I think it's up to roughly 700.
With accuracy. I mean, it'll measure these, but the error bars get huge. That's right. MAP, which is the United States satellite. Yeah. So, there are two satellites that are planned going up. You know, looking at the home pages of these satellites, you don't get really the feeling that they're guaranteed to go up. MAP will almost certainly go up. That's the U.S. one. It's scheduled to go up in the year 2000, maybe more realistically 2001, and it will pin down certainly what the value of Omega is. Probably what the value of Omega Lambda is. Then the Planck satellite, which is the European Space Agency, which does even better. It goes out much higher, and all the error bars are much smaller. Neither one of them are, as far as I know, going to measure polarization, which is too bad.
MAP
will try.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yes, there are other people who are trying. That's certainly true, which is good. We should support them.
Yes, I agree.